I'm Marco Werman. One of the things I love about our show is all the music we feature from around the globe. We've heard from so many listeners that music on the world is something they look forward to. I know many of you become fans of the artists we introduce you to. I'm sure you're aware that we have a fundraiser going on right now. When you make a gift of $100 or pledge $10 a month, we'll send you a curated playlist highlighting some of our team's favorite tracks from the show. Whether you tune in for the music or the independent reporting on international issues, it's your support that keeps us going strong. Please give today to help power our nonprofit newsroom. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. Again, that's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Now, on to the show.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Joe Biden and Xi Jinping meet in California. It's their first face-to-face in a year. Amid simmering tensions, the goals are modest.
They've been trying to limit expectations for just how much the world should expect from a single four-hour meeting.
Also today in Israel, all eyes are on the hostages held by Hamas. The refrain of "bring them home now" is plastered on posters, T-shirts, and TV. Families and loved ones of hostages know that time is not on their side.
There has to be some kind of negotiated agreement.
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show today, a cookbook author savors the taste of her home city, a porridge from Lagos, Nigeria.
It's something that I always turn to for comfort. It's almost like eating oatmeal in the morning. It's just warm and comforting, and it feels like a hug in a bowl.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. For the third straight day, all eyes are on the largest hospital in the Gaza Strip. Israeli troops today have breached the Shifa hospital complex itself and are searching it for evidence of Hamas. The Israeli military said it was carrying out a targeted operation in an area separate from where patients and medical staff are located. A senior official with the Gaza Health Ministry, though, said Israeli forces ransacked the basement and buildings that house the emergency and surgery departments. Neither side is reporting any clashes inside the hospital. U.S. intelligence says Hamas militants have used Shifa and other hospitals to support military operations and hold hostages. Ahead, we'll have more about hostage negotiations. But first today, we go to the U.K., where a flagship British immigration plan suffered a huge blow. The U.K. Supreme Court ruled that the government's policy to send asylum seekers to Rwanda was in breach of both British and international laws. The plan was central to a pledge made by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to cut down on the number of migrants crossing the English Channel to Britain on small boats. Despite the Supreme Court ruling, Sunak said today he is not giving up on the idea. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry is here to explain. I mean, no matter how Rishi Sunak tries to spin this, Orla, it's got to be a serious setback for him and his government's immigration policy.
Yeah, there's no way of glossing over this, really, is there? The Supreme Court ruling was emphatic. This was a unanimous ruling by the five sitting judges. They said the Rwanda policy in its current framework, it goes against international law because simply it doesn't prevent genuine asylum seekers who are fleeing persecution from being sent back to their home country where they could face further persecution. The judge said this morning Rwanda doesn't sufficiently protect refugees and that there's a risk that judges and lawyers in Rwanda will not act independently of the Rwandan government. He also pointed out that there's evidence that almost 100% of refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen and Iran who have already fled to Rwanda previously seeking asylum, that they've had their asylum claims refused. And in the UK, if you come from one of those four countries, there is pretty much around a 90% chance of being granted asylum.
So what is the next move for the British government?
Well, speaking in Parliament this afternoon, Rishi Sunak was much more sort of upbeat than you'd expect him to be. He said that he accepts the ruling, but he said his government is already working on a new plan.
The government has already been working in advance on a new treaty with Rwanda, which we will finalise in light of today's judgment. But let me say this again. If it becomes clear that our domestic legal frameworks or international conventions are still frustrating plans at that point, I am prepared to change our laws and revisit those international relationships. The British people expect us to do whatever it takes to stop the boats, and that is precisely what this government will deliver.
And he was even more bullish this evening, Marco, about it. I mean, he talked about introducing emergency legislation to make sure that the plan would go ahead. He said that no foreign court would be in a position to stop the flights going ahead. And this is in reference to the European Court of Human Rights. Some in the Conservative Party have been saying that Britain should leave the European Convention of Human Rights, which this court is a part of. And Sunak hinted at that today, but he didn't really clarify that he would do that. What is clear is that what he's trying to do is to appeal to the hard right wing of the Conservative Party, those that want to see the Rwanda plan happen, those that want to see an end to migrants crossing the channel on small boats. And he was asked if he can guarantee that a plane will leave for Rwanda before the next general election, which is presumably next year. And he said they're working hard to get a plane off the ground before next spring. But honestly, that seems highly unlikely given all the challenges a brand new treaty would face.
And what about Rwanda, Orla? Was there any official response from the Rwandan government in Kigali today on this ruling?
There was. A government spokesperson issued a statement very shortly after the ruling this morning, and they said they took issue with the idea that Rwanda was not a safe country for asylum seekers. Interestingly, Rwandan opposition politicians have also been out, and they've been critical also of the UK plan with the Rwandan government. They said the UK should not be striking a deal with Rwanda on this whole issue because it's reneging on its own responsibilities to host refugees fleeing persecution. And one opposition party leader said, look, we already have refugees in this country who are fleeing persecution, people who themselves are from Rwanda. You know, who are we to be taking in refugees fleeing persecution from another country?
Right. Well, so far, no asylum seekers have actually been sent to Rwanda from the UK, but they have been threatened with deportation there. How have asylum seekers or groups that work with them reacted to today's Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, refugee groups, they talked about it being a vindication of what they've been saying all along, that the plan is dangerous, that it's inhumane. Lawyers for some of those asylum seekers who were facing deportation to Rwanda were in the court today. One of them, Tufik Hussein, who represents several of the asylum seekers, he spoke outside the courthouse this morning.
This judgment and this victory is a victory for our brave clients who stood up to what is an unlawful and an inhumane policy. Today, it's not just a victory for them, but it's a victory for the rule of law. It's a reminder that no one is above the law.
Another lawyer who represents one of the asylum seekers from Iran was also at the court, and she was saying her client, he was hugely relieved because he fled persecution in Iran, and she was saying if his claim was processed in Britain, he would almost certainly be granted asylum. But according to the Supreme Court today, if his case was heard in Rwanda, he would almost certainly be sent back home.
Interesting. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barrett giving us the latest on news that the Supreme Court in the UK has struck down an immigration policy that would have sent asylum seekers to Rwanda. Orla, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Agree on a few things and then politely agree to disagree on a few more. That seems to be the game plan today as President Joe Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping sit down for about 4 hours of talks outside of San Francisco. Xi and Biden's first face-to-face meeting in a year is taking place on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. For more on what's at stake with the APEC summit, we reached out to Jude Blanchette. He's the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. High-level diplomatic relations between the U.S. and China were frozen for part of the past year, Jude. The build-up to this meeting feels like it's more than just symbolism. What is on the line as these two leaders sit down for the first time in many months?
One of the reasons there's a lot riding on this meeting is this is really a question of, are the first and second largest economy in the world with two of the largest militaries going to demonstrate that they can find ways to begin talking about significantly consequential issues, not just for the two respective nations, but I think for the globe as a whole.
Yeah, so let's look at some of that low-hanging fruit, if you will, at the summit aimed at providing something that the two leaders can agree on. What are the kinds of things you expect real progress on?
The administration here and also the Chinese have been doing, they've been trying to limit expectations for just how much the world and the two respective populations should expect from a single four-hour meeting. You know, what we'll see will be things where the proof is in the pudding of how these are implemented. Just a short list is, some agreements on how AI-controlled autonomous drones and nuclear warheads. I think a very consequential one for Americans and a key priority of the Biden administration was trying to get an agreement with China to step up its blockage of Chinese companies which are producing and shipping precursors to fentanyl, the drug fentanyl, and shipping those to the United States. And then finally, is there going to be a resumption of direct military-to-military dialogue, which was cut off by the Chinese in response to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan last year?
Yeah, spell out why, briefly, restoring communications is so important.
We have a number of areas, something called the Second Thomas Shoal in the South China Sea, where we're right now the United States, the Philippines, and China are in very close proximity to each other, and there's a real potential that that could spill over into a real crisis. And then, of course, we have Taiwan, which the United States does not have formal diplomatic relations with, but is a close partner of the United States, where we have a wink, wink, nudge, nudge guarantee to provide defense to Taiwan if China invades. So Taiwan in particular is an issue, I think, where a lot are watching this with a great unease about how and if the United States and China will be able to find a modus vivendi to avoid conflict there.
There are also current events that could get forced onto the agenda. Global attention right now is on Gaza and Israel. How will the fighting there figure in the summit?
Yeah, I should also mention the ongoing war in Ukraine and China's ongoing financial and diplomatic support for Russia are also on, so it's a crowded agenda. I think the United States feels that although China clearly is gloating a bit about the prospects of the United States being entrapped in a potentially another theater of conflict, the Chinese also have equities in some stability in the Middle East region, given their reliance on purchases of Middle Eastern energy and oil. So I think the administration is hoping that economic interest on the part of the Chinese can get them to play a more active role in, for example, their relations with Iran, who is a partner of China, but also, as we know, is a key actor in the Middle East that the United States is trying to get its arms around to stop them from potentially inflaming a further conflict in the region.
I mean, Taiwan is a big area of tension and deep disagreement. So is trade, technology transfer, and human rights. Will any of these issues be on the table at this meeting, or is it a non-starter and maybe progress will bring it on the table at the next meeting?
They're all on the table in the sense that the United States will mention its list of issues, which it feels are critical. I think human rights is undoubtedly going to be one of those. I think the Chinese will raise the issues that they care most about, which would be Taiwan and probably U.S. technology restrictions. But again, I don't think we should or can expect that a four-hour meeting is going to solve these. This is the top of the first inning.
Also today, Chinese leader Xi is meeting with U.S. business and cultural leaders. Why is that important to him?
The Chinese economy is undergoing a pretty significant deterioration right now. It's not collapse, but it certainly is a change in trajectory from what we've become accustomed to of rapid growth. China is slowing to about 5% this year, which is good by American standards, but pretty poor by Chinese. And more importantly, I think Xi Jinping understands that the foreign business community has really turned sour on the Chinese market. They're hesitant to invest there. They're worried about political risk. They're worried about regulatory risk. So to Xi Jinping, having a dinner with America's most prominent CEOs and then broadcasting those images in China, in the United States, and around the world, I think would, in Xi Jinping's view, give a bit of a confidence jolt to the economy.
Jude Blanchette is the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, going over with us the historic meeting today between Chinese leader Xi Jinping and President Biden. Jude, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
The U.S. women's national soccer team has a newly announced head coach. Her name is Emma Hayes.
Some of you ain't been good enough. We expect more. You.
Here she is telling it like it is in the locker room of the Chelsea women's team earlier this year. Hayes has built that squad into a powerhouse since 2012. This is Chelsea in 2015 as they became the UK Super League champions for the first time in the club's history. And that was just a warm-up. Since then, they've won that title again and again.
Chelsea are champions for the fourth season in succession.
In 2021, FIFA named Emma Hayes the best women's soccer coach in the world. She's now coming to America to help the U.S. women's team rebound from the summer's disappointment at the World Cup.
It is a cruel way to lose on penalties. Cruel way.
It is, was. The U.S. women's team had an unmatched record, four women's World Cup titles, four Olympic gold medals. Now it's up to Emma Hayes to revive that prowess. Here she is on the BBC last year, explaining her philosophy.
We're human beings. We become stale. We become static. We become complacent. We all do it. For me, challenging the players is my single biggest preoccupation.
Emma Hayes takes charge of the U.S. women starting next May. She'll have just 2 months to turn stale into crisp before the Summer Olympic Games in Paris. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Israel, if you turn on the radio or TV or you're just walking down the street, you see and hear one phrase on repeat these days: bring them home now. Them refers to the more than 230 hostages captured by Hamas during the deadly October 7th attack on Israel. One man who's familiar with what it takes to bring hostages home is Gershon Baskin. In 2011, he negotiated with Hamas to win the release of an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, who was held captive in Gaza for 5 years. The World's Matthew Bell sat down with Gershon Baskin at his home in Jerusalem to learn what the current hostage situation looks like through his eyes.
I've talked to some family members of hostages. It's just heartbreaking to hear the situation that they're in. When they speak up, and they have been speaking up, what kind of pressure does that put on the Israeli government? Do you think it could work to get them out?
I was contacted by families from day one, and they asked me for advice. And the first piece of advice that I gave was, speak up. The government is going to tell you to be quiet. The government is going to tell you that the more you speak, the larger the prices that Hamas is going to demand. From my experience, that's completely irrelevant. And the most important thing for the hostage families to do is to speak up and to put faces and names to the people who are hostages. Because in the end of the day, there has to be some kind of negotiated agreement, whether it is a deal for the women, the children, and the elderly who are released in some kind of exchange with Israel for prisoners, for a ceasefire, for whatever it is they're demanding. I don't think we're going to see the all-for-all deal that people are talking about, releasing all the hostages for 7,000 Palestinian prisoners, including 559 serving life sentences for murdering Israelis and another 130 terrorists who were caught in Israel. I think that Israel will make some kind of deal. We have days left to do it, I think, not much longer than that. And then Israel will engage in rescue operations with special forces to go and find the young men, the soldiers, the policemen who are left behind. And then we're dealing with 60, 70, 80, 90. We don't even know the exact number.
I talked to an Israeli security expert yesterday who said this is very complicated, but the best thing we can do now is keep killing Hamas, keep attacking Hamas, and make a situation so that the hostages are a burden, and then they'll set them free. Does this make sense?
Look, it might be possible. On the other hand, they're holding 240 people or 238 people, whatever the number is. They're expendable. When they held one Israeli soldier, he was very valuable to them. When they're holding 230 or 40 or whatever the number is, hostages that are problematic logistically to keep, babies, old people who are sick and need medication, other people, they're expendable. And I think that we saw a video just last night of a girl who looked to me that she was killed by Hamas. They're claiming that she was killed in the Israeli bombing. We don't really know. But I'm very fearful that the extreme Israeli pressure on Hamas, it could have the reverse effect, not necessarily pressure them to make a deal, but in fact get rid of some of the hostages.
Put you on the spot with some criticism, and one that comes to mind. Soon after October 7th, I read there was an op-ed written in an American newspaper that said, look, this deal with Gilad Shalit, trading one Israeli soldier for 1,000 political prisoners, was a bad idea. The writer said he hoped the Israelis don't do this again. And as harsh as it sounds, defeat Hamas, worry about the prisoners second. When you hear this, what goes through your mind?
There are two things that I respond to that. One is that there is part of the Israeli ethos that we don't leave anyone behind. And after 5 years and 4 months in captivity, the Israeli government decided to make the deal. Not Gershon Baskin. I helped to facilitate the negotiations. But Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, and 26 members of his government voted for the deal, because the ethos of not leaving anyone behind was more important than not negotiating with terrorists. This was the decision of the country at the time, and it was felt that in order to have a people's army, this was mandatory. Was it a good deal? No, it was not a good deal. Did anyone ask my opinion of the deal? No, they didn't. If they had, what would I have said? I would have said that you, the Israeli government, said that when there's no longer an Israeli soldier in Gaza, we can change the relationship with Gaza. We can open the siege on Gaza. We can negotiate a long-term ceasefire. Did they ever do that? No, they didn't. In fact, the situation in Gaza got worse. The situation in the West Bank got worse. The political issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was removed from our agenda. Five rounds of elections in Israel, and we never dealt with the Israeli-Palestinian issue in those elections because Benjamin Netanyahu convinced us we have no partner, and he convinced the world that we have no partner.
What happened on October 7th not only shocked Israelis, it just seems like a total game-changing event. And Palestinians have told me this, Israelis have told me this. What do you think, if there is a way to get the hostages back, is that a way to turn the corner and go somewhere better on this long, terrible problem?
Two things. One, if it's perceived that Israel decided to sacrifice the hostages, as some people in the Israeli government, the right-wing extremists in the Israeli government, say we need to do because our primary mission is to dismantle Hamas's ability to ever govern and threaten Israel again. And I think that's essential. It has to be done. Hamas lost the right to exist. But even if that's not the case, and some hostages are retrieved, others are rescued, and others are not, the day after this war, we have to face the reality that for Israel, this is the biggest trauma that we face since the Holocaust. And without making comparisons, for the Palestinians, this is the biggest trauma they face since the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. They are facing another catastrophe. If we don't wake up the day after and learn that we have to begin to look forward, this is a new narrative. This is a new chapter in our collective memories that we will never forget. But if we don't look forward and accept the basic principle that there are 7 million people who are Israeli Jews here and 7 million people who are Palestinian Arabs who are living on the same land that they claim is their homeland, and we don't recognize that everyone's living here has the same right to the same rights, then we will just continue doing this for another 100 years as we've been doing it. This has to be the game changer. This has to be what I've been calling the Belfast moment. Which wasn't a moment in Belfast, it was a process. But nonetheless, after years, hundreds of years of killing each other, people in Northern Ireland decided it's time to stop. And that's what we need to have happen here. Our leaders have to pay the price for the failures that brought us here on both sides. Israeli and Palestinian leaders, we need new leadership with new hopes and new dreams and new visions and new abilities. And the ability mainly to look forward. For Palestinians, I say it's time to begin to live for Palestine and not die for Palestine. And for Israelis, I say it's time to recognize that there's another people living in this land and it's also theirs. So we need to find the ability to do that, to look forward. It can only be done if the international community forces us to deal with the reality that if it's the two-state solution, that seems to be what everyone's talking about again, which was probably not viable in the last years and maybe will become viable again. You have to make it happen by forcing the Israelis and the Palestinians to enter into a process that will be regional, not bilateral, Israeli-Palestinian, but involving the neighborhood, Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Bahrain, etc., supported by the European Union and the United States and other countries. We have to rebuild Gaza. We have to boost the Palestinian economy. We have to create Palestinian independence and the Israeli occupation and bring a lot of support here for people to learn together, to live together in peace. We have to re-educate each other that we all are here and all have the right to be here. And that's a big step to make.
Gershon Baskin is with the International Communities Organization. He's best known as a negotiator who secured the 2011 release of an Israeli soldier who was held by Hamas on the Gaza Strip for 5 years. He was speaking there with my colleague, the world's Matthew Bell, in Jerusalem. Our coverage of the war in Gaza includes perspectives from all sides. Read and listen more at theworld.org and in our podcast feed. In New York City, churches, mosques, and synagogues are transforming into housing for immigrants.
The nature of church is to connect to community.
This resident says here you can feel the calmness.
Realmente aquí se sentía calma.
But expanding this plan is hitting some snags. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 50 churches, synagogues, mosques, and temples in New York City might soon become home to nearly 1,000 immigrant men. with something like 600 new migrants arriving in New York each day. The city this past summer announced a plan to pay houses of worship to help fill the desperate need for shelter. As Gisele Regatao reports from New York, turning faith-based organizations into housing has been a lot harder than expected.
Many immigrants who arrive in New York City end up here, at the St. Paul and St. Andrew United Methodist Church in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Once a week, about 200 people come to the church for an event that got nicknamed Miracle Monday. Here they can get food, clothes, toys, and legal help. But for Angel Herrera, the church was home, too.
Mi cama estaba allá. Incluso era aquella, si no mal recuerdo.
We are in a small room on the third floor of the church.
En esta recámara éramos tres personas.
We were three people in this room, he says. Herrera is 28 years old and is from Venezuela. When he arrived in New York in May, he came straight to St. Paul and St. Andrew because his cousin was already living here. At the end of September, they were able to move to an apartment. But Herrera says he has great memories of living in this church.
Realmente aquí se sentía calma.
Here, one could feel calmness, a lot of peace, he says. Herrera is one of 15 immigrants who have lived in this church since August of last year. But St. Paul and St. Andrew is not applying for the program launched by the city.
Look at where we are. We're in a building that is 120-plus years old. It is landmarked.
Associate Pastor Lee Matthews says she wishes the church could participate. But their old building can't meet the requirements, having sprinklers, alarms, showers, and a space for 19 beds.
A great many of the ideas that birthed that program came out of our group, namely out of this congregation even, and we wouldn't qualify.
More than 200 houses of worship have applied for the program, but only two have been approved so far. Gail Brewer is a council member that represents parts of Manhattan, including the Upper West Side. She says the problem is that the fire department is imposing standards that are tougher than for permanent shelters.
The fire department, with all due respect, is putting too many roadblocks. Many of the people who have requested to be home, basically, for some of these migrants, have been doing it for 40 or 30 years with Americans. I know them because I've slept overnight in some of these places.
Brewer says she has supported the new program because houses of worship offer many advantages.
People get jobs, and people from the congregation get to know them and give them opportunities that you would never get in a shelter. And it's also really safe.
The only two churches that have been approved by the program are in the Bronx. I visited both of them and spoke to their pastors, but as part of their contracts with the city, they are not allowed to talk to the press. For Reverend Matthews from St. Paul and St. Andrew, social work is a fundamental part of the modern church.
To imagine that in order to connect with the holy, you have to come into a building, sit in a pew, and receive. This is an outdated model, and the nature of church is to connect to community.
In the past 2 years, their congregation increased by almost 10%. She says many members joined to participate in their social justice work. That's against the national trend, where religious affiliation is down. With or without the support from the city, New York has a long tradition of having religious organizations serve as shelters.
This is a program of the city now that seems to be recognizing that that religious communities have been doing this all along.
Ken Guest is a professor of anthropology at Baruch College, where I also work as a journalism professor. Guest studies immigration and religion.
But at the same time, it may not be recognizing the complexities of trying to offload a government program onto a not-for-profit religious organization.
Guest says soon after New York City established a righteous shelter in 1981, houses of worship were called in to assist.
I think for a lot of churches and synagogues, engaging as a part of the homeless shelter system starting in the 1980s was a major rethink of how they did church.
One of the oldest shelters inside a church is located in the basement of Broadway Presbyterian. The church is in Upper Manhattan, across the street from Columbia University. Isaac Adlerstein is the executive director of Broadway Community, the organization that runs the shelter and soup kitchen. He says he's disappointed that the city's program is behind schedule.
It's incredibly frustrating. I mean, when we first conceived of expanding this, the idea was to create a shelter model that is very low barrier for institutions to enter into.
Adlerstein says shelters at houses of worship are much cheaper, and he believes as many as 1,000 of them could house 15 people each.
That's 15,000 beds added to the shelter system. And suddenly, you're then able to kind of hit the pause button on the problematic shelters, fix them up, make the system better overall. I think it just makes sense.
Mayor Adams' administration and the fire department both declined to be interviewed for this story. At St. Paul and St. Andrew, Venezuelan immigrant Angel Herrera is back at the church to get legal help. But he says living here made him more connected to religion, too. I was able to hear the services from far away, and I like them very much, he says. For The World, I'm Gisele Regatao, New York City.
The story was part of our Sacred Nation series about religion and nationalism across the globe. To hear more stories like this, head to our website, theworld.org/sacrednation. Another wartime winter is approaching for Ukraine, meaning preparations are underway both on the front line and at home, where the threat of power outages is looming for the second winter in a row. Joanne Nahorska from the International Rescue Committee explained to us how ordinary Ukrainians are preparing.
This summer, when we're speaking to some of the people we're working with, they were telling us that they already started stocking up on firewood. People were preserving whatever they had in their gardens, such as fruit and vegetables. And they started making preparations. They started thinking on what clothes they need to buy for their children.
For more on this, we're turning to Lillian Bivings. She's the business editor at the Kyiv Independent. So in Kyiv, Lillian, how are you preparing for the winter?
Yeah, so I actually bought something that's called like an accumulator here in Ukraine. It's kind of like a giant power bank that you have at home that you charge up. And in case the power goes out, you can plug in things like your Wi-Fi router, space heater, obviously a lamp, obviously charge your laptop and phone and things like that.
Is that the kind of device in Kyiv many people have access to?
Yeah, they sell them everywhere. They sell them online. Everyone I know has one. We have them at the Kyiv Independent office. We have multiple ones, actually, very large ones, in addition to a generator, which is another thing that a lot of people in Kyiv, not individuals, of course, but businesses, cafes, restaurants are all stocking up on.
Right. So that's urban centers. What about people living near the front lines? Does preparing for winter and the cold look any different for them?
It looks completely different. Based on, you know, our reporters who spend time in the front lines and talk to people out there, people are mostly living day by day, just closing their windows with wooden boards. If the glass has been shattered by shelling, you know, they don't really think much about the future and that kind of planning for a months-long difficult winter, right? It's really the priority is the next few days, being able to find food, having access to water. You know, they've dealt with it before. They've dealt with difficult winters. I mean, especially on the front lines since 2014, right? Not even just the last winter.
Yeah, very hard to plan when you're on the front line. Last winter, we got to remember Russian military attacks targeted power stations, other parts of the energy network in Ukraine, triggering widespread blackouts across the country. This week, President Zelensky warned Russia may do the same thing again this winter. Is there anything the government is doing differently this time around this year to try to protect critical infrastructure?
You know, they say, at least publicly, that they have a lot more air defenses, that they are able to protect cities and critical infrastructure a lot better this winter than they were last winter. You know, the energy companies, state-owned and privately owned energy companies, have said that they've repaired a lot of the damages that happened last winter. But of course, repairing half a very large country's energy system in a matter of months is not possible. And it's been difficult to get the types of equipment they've needed to make those repairs. So it's hard to know exactly how prepared that infrastructure is to withstand attacks.
Yeah. As far as communities on the front lines, how much help can those people expect from the government this winter? Like, are people going to have to come out near the front lines to repair downed electrical lines, for example, or will the government be there for them?
Yeah, I think in some areas they will be able to get out there and repair things, you know, day by day, but it's really difficult. On the front lines, you have thousands of smaller transformer points or regional substations there on the front lines have been damaged or completely destroyed. And they do go out there and try to repair them, but it's very difficult because, for one, it's very dangerous, and two, there's this very high risk that they will be damaged immediately again, right? So I think the recommendation is really that people leave frontline areas, especially in winter.
There's also the basic necessity of just heating. I know half of Ukraine, about half, uses district heating, meaning water or steam is heated up at a central power plant, and that water or steam provides heat in homes. How did those systems fare last winter, and did a lot of people just not have heat?
It depends. You know, some people, if they live in private homes, you know, smaller homes outside of the city, they're able to heat their own homes with burning wood or even coal. So it really depends. If you live in a high rise and there's no heat, yeah, that's it. There's no heat. You're just very cold.
So the energy minister for Ukraine has said that the country will have enough energy resources for the winter. Just what does that look like? Is it stockpiled coal and gas primarily?
Yeah. So, I mean, the country is, you know, under martial law during the war. They're not allowed to export any gas. But at the same time, DTEC, Ukraine's largest energy company, is importing a lot of coal to prepare for the winter in case it needs it. But, you know, quite frankly, I don't think that Ukraine does have excess capacity, meaning like what it has is really exactly what it needs, and it doesn't have anything else. So it'll be really difficult if for any reason large parts of the power system are shut off.
Lillian Bivings is the business editor of the Kyiv Independent. Lillian, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you. You too.
It's that time of year when the college football season is getting hot on campuses across the country. I'm, of course, talking American football now, which has never really caught on widely outside the U.S. So for international students studying here, the hype around the game usually gets lost in translation. Shannon Young reports from Boulder, Colorado.
Home game days draw college students and alumni alike to college campuses around the country, where there are tailgating parties, pep events, and bands playing the school fight song. Most of it is foreign to anyone not raised in the United States. To help out new arrivals, many colleges offer a short class, for no credit, to foreigners who don't know the difference between a scrimmage and a sack. According to the program's co-founder, Colorado State University was the first to offer Football 101 for international students. Darshan Shah says the idea came to him after an interaction with a then-classmate when he was a student at Colorado State University.
CSU was having a really great year in football. They were nationally ranked, and there was a lot of buzz around campus. And a fellow student from Saudi had started asking me questions about football. And as the conversation went on, I could tell that he would really like to go to a game, but he was feeling a little bit of intimidation.
Shah, the U.S.-born son of Indian immigrants, wanted a way for international students to be more connected with their school and to their community.
There's an opportunity here for making this just a much more comfortable experience by making a proper introduction to the environment and to the game.
The first thing Football 101 teaches are the rules and scoring. But the seminar also includes learning about athletic traditions like cheerleading, school colors, and mascots. And, of course, there's a field trip to a football game.
We set up a special section in the stadium so they can all sit together. And by doing it that way, it becomes a comfortable experience.
Saleh Al-Mansouri is a first-year student from the United Arab Emirates. He attends regional rival University of Colorado, which does not offer a Football 101 class. Al-Mansouri realized shortly after his arrival that learning about American football would help him to better understand campus culture.
So what I did is I just went to YouTube and watched some videos about it. And it's a really easy sport to understand, but when you're in a real-life stadium and everything, it's really difficult because of the lines and everything. You don't really understand it.
At the Boulder campus, the football season this year has been more than just about the sport. The university invested millions of dollars to hire media-savvy sports celebrity Deion Sanders as head coach of the football team. The high expectations have drawn media crews and celebrities to home games. Second-year Kuwaiti student Hind Saeed says the hype this semester has been surreal.
It actually genuinely feels like a movie, like an American coming-of-age movie.
But the amount of attention American football gets can feel disproportionate to some students who just aren't that into it.
Yeah, I get it. We're excited, but it's a lot for just this like one tiny thing on campus compared to all the amazing other things that the school and the students bring together.
Juanita Hurtado is a second-year student from Colombia. She's not a fan of football, or at least not American football.
I adore soccer. Football, which actually makes sense. Like, I'm so sorry. I don't understand why American football is called football. You don't really, like, kick the ball that often. But soccer, you kick the ball every single time. So in that sense, like, I think the world should belong to us instead of Americans. I'm so sorry. Hot take, but yes.
Hurtado says she tried to convert an American friend to her kind of football and vice versa without much success. Regardless, she says the role of sports and community cohesion is undeniable.
Sports do create a lot of money and a lot of jobs. They are kind of important, but they also create like the sense of community of you can find things to love within those games, even if you're not a sports fan.
For students far from home, at least knowing the rules of the game and maybe even the lyrics to a fight song can help make the difference between feeling left out and fitting right in. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Boulder, Colorado.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Take a spin through your local grocery store, and with some creativity and the right guide, the ingredients you take home can transport you to another place entirely. Our next guest can show your belly the way to Nigeria. Yewande Komolafe grew up in the country's biggest city, Lagos. She's a food writer with the New York Times and has just published a cookbook about the food of her hometown. It's called My Everyday Lagos, Nigerian Cooking at Home and in the Diaspora. Hello, Yewande. Great to meet you.
Good to meet you. Thank you for having me.
So your new cookbook is more than a bunch of recipes. It's also kind of a love letter to Lagos and a search to define your own identity through food. What inspired you to write it?
I think that living here in the U.S. and not being able to go home, I go through it in the book where I tell the story of being undocumented and not being able to access the place that I grew up to the extent that I started to wonder if I really grew up in Lagos and if I really had a childhood in Nigeria. And so food is the way I translate the world, and it felt natural to turn to food to help me explain and describe my experiences. And that was the inspiration behind the cookbook.
Yeah, in your late teens, you came to the U.S. You went to culinary school, you worked in restaurants, and you were not able to return to Lagos for 18 years. In that time, what were the challenges you ran into when you first started trying to reproduce the authentic flavors of Nigeria?
I wondered what authenticity was. I had that question come up a lot for me. Like, am I still Nigerian if I haven't been there or if I haven't revisited? Is this stew or these plantains that I'm making in Brooklyn in my kitchen, are they Nigerian because I'm making them or are they Nigerian because the recipe's Nigerian? And I kind of just shifted to the idea and decided that the food that I make is authentic to my experience and that is what it is. I think also a challenge was that I was making a lot of these things from memory and from conversations, talking to my mom, talking to my aunt, remembering how my grandmother cooked. And so I wasn't working off of a script of recipes that I already had. I was kind of creating the recipes from what I remembered.
Yeah. So when you finally were able to return to Lagos for a visit in 2017, how much had the food there changed from your childhood or changed from your memory of what you had eaten?
It was so exciting to find out that the flavors and the tastes that I remembered were so much more intense than I remembered. I was cooking food from Nigeria in Brooklyn, but I felt when I returned to Lagos that what I was making was just, it wasn't intense enough. Like everything in Lagos and in Nigeria just inspired me so much. And it felt like my senses were on fire the entire time I was there. And so when I returned, when I came back from that trip, I just intensified like the pepper in my stews and like the spices in my pepper soup. All my flavors got way more intense and impactful.
Tell us about a few dishes in your cookbook, Yewande, that are really staples of cooking in Lagos.
There's akara, which is it's a fritter made from ground honey beans. It's slightly sweet. If you decide to put some onions in it like I do, it's got that aromatic flavor. It's something that just reminds me of like celebrations. It's celebration food. It's something that reminds me of my grandmother because she would always make it and wrap it up in newspapers and send it by courier to us. And it requires a gentle touch to make it fluffy and light. I also talk about ogi, which is something that I learned to make during the pandemic, just long hours of sitting home with my one-year-old. Mm. And ogi is a porridge made from fermented cornstarch. And it's a morning food. It's just something that settles your stomach. It's something that I always turn to for comfort. It's almost like eating oatmeal in the morning. It's just warm and comforting, and it feels like a hug in a bowl. And I started buying different colors of corn because it's typically made with white and yellow corn. But I discovered here that I could get like heirloom pink corn or indigo blue corn. And so I started experimenting with different colors of corn. And now I make like a blush pink ogi or like an indigo ogi. And it's just fascinating to see that process.
I love that description, a warm hug in a bowl. But that, you know, the porridgey thing is pretty common all across Nigeria and West Africa, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we eat a lot of porridges. We eat a lot of starches that have been cooked down until they just like sort of melt away into the broth.
In Nigeria, I mean, Lagos, it's a massive city with commuters spending long hours on the road. How does that day-to-day reality affect who does the cooking and what they cook?
There's a lot of prep that happens ahead of time. And the way I arranged the book by the chapters were kind of as a direct result of that experience of spending time in traffic Monday through Friday in Nigeria. My 2020 trip to Nigeria, I spent a lot of time just like commuting back and forth and spending time in traffic and just going back and forth. And I realized how much time is spent in traffic. And I realized that that does influence the amount of time that you have to cook. And so I noticed that my mom would make a lot of things on the weekends, and a lot of the ingredients she used were like broken down and prepped on the weekends. And so it made the meal times just so much quicker. And so I've sort of adopted that thought process and that prep process, if you will, where I always have ata dindin in my fridge. And that's the base for so many of our Nigerian dishes. And so when I come home after work, when the kids are like running around and wanting to eat, I just know that I can pull out my ata dindin and make some white rice, and then we have a meal. And so there's a lot of prep that happens ahead of time.
And finally, fufu, how can you make that in such a way that it is just like exactly like what you get in Lagos?
Oh, gosh, you're asking for a lot there.
You need the mortar and pestle, and you need somebody who's willing to
pound away at it. Yeah, you absolutely need the mortar and pestle. But I mean, now there's like substitutions. And, you know, honestly, most people use the powders in Nigeria also. Not everybody's like buying yams or cassava root and pounding it from scratch.
We should describe fufu before we go any further.
That's true. Fufu is a starch that has been either mashed or pounded into a dough that's elastic. And it's typically used as a vessel for soups and stews. But now they're dehydrated powders made from the starches. So there's like cassava root powder or yam powder. There's gari, which is a fermented and dehydrated cassava granules that are used to make this fufu. And you can make it either by pounding the starch or by boiling the starch and then mashing it. Or you could also just grab a powder and make it into a dough. So there are different ways you could make it. If you're looking for that exact taste that you would have in Lagos, I think that you just have to hop on a plane and go there.
Well, we don't need to do that thanks to your cookbook. Yewande Kumolafe is the author of My Everyday Lagos, Nigerian Cooking at Home and in the Diaspora. Great to meet you, and thank you for the conversation about Nigerian food. This was fun.
So lovely to chat with you. Thank you so much, Marco.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, eat more fufu, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now the world is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much and be well.